Yeah, it's great to see so many people out. And Pastor James asked me to say a few words. Those of you who don't know me, I work on campus as a campus pastor. I'm a friend of UCM. And I guess I'm qualified to talk, if you could say that, because I've worked as a pastor in quite a few countries on quite a few continents and have been blessed by getting to know Christians from around the world. And that's sort of what I wanted to talk on tonight for just 10 minutes or so. You don't know it, even though it's all around you. But this is one of the most amazing times to be a Christian. Christianity is transitioning from being a Western religion to being a truly global faith. And I don't just mean that there are individual Christians in all sorts of countries. There are. What I mean is that the good news about Jesus Christ is taking on flesh and blood shape in cultures, nations, all around the world, more and more so every year. Now, a lot of people don't know this, and if we were to go outside and canvass people on campus, they would say, oh, Christianity, that's a Western religion, and a lot of professors say that as well, and I've heard them say it, but they're wrong. That's what it was like a century ago. Their image of a typical Christian was this. Can you show them, Seth? Or not. So 100 years ago, the beginning of the 20th century, 85% of the Christians in the world were white. They were of European background. And Christianity was a thoroughly Western religion. It thought out the faith in a Western way. It worshipped in a Western way. I don't mean a country in Western way. That would be cool. But I mean like a Western way in terms of instruments and just how we conducted ourselves. And Western missionaries and colonialism exported Christianity around the world. That was then, though. That was 100 years ago. This is what the Christian map looks like today. What we see is this remarkable equal distribution of Christians around the world. Christianity is a truly world faith with almost equal representations of Christians in sub-Saharan Africa, in Latin America, Europe, and then in Asia and North America with very similar contingents. And I want to underscore this because we often talk about world religions, and I've taught a course in university on world religions. The fact is, there's really only one world religion in the sense that it's equally distributed around the world. Hinduism, we know, is a great world faith, but 99% of the world's Hindus live in one country, India. Buddhism is a world religion, but 90% of Buddhists live in Asia. And Islam, a world faith, but 70% of Muslims live in Asia, in one continent. Christianity is spread around the world. All around the world, people are finding in Jesus Christ life, the answer to their deepest questions and some of their deepest longings. And I want to say that this has been God's plan all along, to bring people from every tongue and tribe into his story, a story that we find told in the Bible. At the very beginning, God chooses a single family, and he promises to bless the world through this family. This is the family of Abraham and Sarah, and their child is Israel. And Israel, this nation, is to be a light to all nations. And it's from this nation that God's own son, Jesus Christ, comes into, takes on flesh. He is the light of the world, as the Bible says. Describes him, and God's plan to heal and forgive the world through the death and resurrection of Jesus always had all peoples, all nations in view. The earliest followers of Jesus, the people who began the church, recognized that the good news about Jesus was for all people, even though often there was a tension between their belief in Jesus as the savior of all humankind and the fact that most of them were ethnic Jews. There's this tension that runs in a lot of the New Testament. One of my favorite stories is from the book of Acts, which is in the New Testament, the second part of the Christian Bible. And it's a book that tells the story of the first Christians. One of my favorite stories, which you can bring the text up, it's one that a lot of Christians don't read, or they read it and they don't recognize how incredibly important it is. So I just want to read it to you, and then I'm going to parse it for you, just to make a point. Now, what's happening here is that there's a persecution in the city of Jerusalem. Some of the very first Christians are being persecuted, so they flee the city. And I'm reading here from Acts chapter 11. Now, those who were scattered because of the persecution that took place over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch, and there they spoke the word to no one except Jews. So what we have here is followers of Jesus who are ethnic Jews fleeing the city of Jerusalem and going out and telling others the good news about Jesus, but they're only speaking to their own kind. They're only speaking to other Jews. But among them were some men of Cyprus and Cyrene who, on coming to Antioch, spoke to the Hellenists, those who spoke Greek, proclaiming the Lord Jesus. And the hand of the Lord was upon them, and a great number became believers and turned to the Lord. It was in Antioch that the disciples were first called Christians. So just to lay this out, what we find at the moment where people first start to use this word Christian, you know, we toss this word around as if it always existed. It didn't. It came into existence at a very particular moment. And it was this moment when three continents come together. Cyprus is an island in the Mediterranean. It's Greek-speaking. It's part of Europe. Cyrene is what the Romans called North Africa. So we have Africans and Europeans coming to the great Asian city of Antioch, and they're sharing the good news about Jesus Christ to people who spoke a different language. So at the birth of the church, where people are first called Christians, we have three continents coming together. Christianity was never supposed to be a Western religion. From its origins, from its very beginning, the good news of Jesus Christ was for all people, and the church was made up of people from all continents. Remarkable. One of the reasons why, like during the history of the church, like in the Middle Ages, Christians used to like to imagine the world through a map. And show them the map, Seth. If you're ever traveling, don't use this map to get around. This is a symbolic rendering of the world. This comes from the 16th century, and it's German. But this is how Christians like to imagine the world. The very center, if you can read it, is a city, Jerusalem. And what they're saying is that Jesus Christ, born a Jew, lived and moved in and among the city of Jerusalem, was crucified there, was raised from the dead there. This city is sort of the spiritual epicenter of the church. And then what we see is three continents, Europa, Europe, Asia, and Africa. And as you can see in this symbolic rendering, they're all equal. There's no claim made that Europe is better or Asia is better. The gospel of Jesus Christ, the good news about Jesus, is for all people, and the church is made up of people from all continents. Now, for historic reasons, particularly because of the rise of Islam, what happened is that the Christian church, which existed in India and in Africa and in Europe, was eradicated in Asia and in North Africa. And for because of historic circumstances, the church, by and large, did become a Western religion for about the last 200 or 300 years. But that's changing. And during the 20th century, Christianity has grown exponentially around the world, so that its numeric strength is no longer in Europe or North America, but in particularly in the Southern Hemisphere. And when we go past the numbers, and people who do demographics and statistics will, you know, throw out all the numbers and show us how overwhelming this growth is. But when we go past the numbers to the stories, what we find is this remarkable work of God. And I'll just give you quickly two examples from the context I know best as an academic, as a researcher, and as a pastor. One is from China, and the second is from Africa. So China, You bring up the picture. This is a Chinese house church. Christianity in China has always been very small into the 20th century. And there was great efforts by missionaries to evangelize Chinese people. And those efforts were not particularly successful. And then during the mid-20th century, a communist dictatorship under Mao Zedong took power in China and kicked all the missionaries out of China. And in fact, during the 60s and 70s, during what's called the Cultural Revolution, they banned Christianity. And a lot of the experts and church leaders in the West were despondent because China at that time was the world's largest country and there was no church to speak of. There was no chance to bring the gospel to China. So in this despair and despondency, the exact opposite happened. And what's happened through word of mouth, through a quiet, subtle evangelism in China is an amazing growth of the church. In the mid-20th century, there was a few million Chinese Christians. Today, there's several hundred million. And this has happened despite official persecution from the government, through discrimination, through bans on evangelism. This has happened through quiet, mouth-to-mouth evangelism, sharing the good news as Chinese Christians share with their family and friends how they found meaning in Jesus Christ. The statistics suggest, and I'm drawing on a Chinese sociologist named Fengang Yang, who teaches at Purdue in the States. He thinks that by 2030, so in 12 years, there will be as many Chinese Christians as there are Christians in America. So we're used to saying, God bless America, and that's a loaded political phrase. There may be as many Christians in China in our lifetime. What will that mean for the world, for how we think about being Christian? What's also remarkable is that as China becomes more affluent, as the middle class gains more strength, they're not turning away from religion like we would we've expected them to. They're turning to religion. They're finding in material prosperity, they're finding that material prosperity is not giving them the answers they need to have an abundant life, and they're turning to Jesus instead. Second example, just quickly, is Africa, where I've worked and where I've lived for a number of years. The beginning of the 20th century, there was about 10 million African Christians. And the general thought was that as Africa decolonized, so as the colonial powers pulled out of Africa, Africa would become more secular. They would give up this colonial religion. And the exact opposite has happened. Today, there are about 400 million African Christians. No religion in human history has grown as fast as Christianity did in Africa in the 20th century. Experts who study theology and mission say that the 21st century will belong to the African church, which is an amazing thought. They're going to be the church leaders in the next century, the ones writing the books that we're reading, the ones writing the hymns that we're singing. What happened? What's happened is that Africans, by and large, have found Jesus to be the answer that they've been looking for. It's been Jesus who's given them justice when their own governments couldn't. It's Jesus who's protecting them, who's healing them, who's calling them to new life as they transition from colonial society to independent nations. 100 years ago, I was a normal Christian. I was a normal Christian, a white European male, but I'm not normal anymore. The church has changed. The world has changed because of the church. And as I said before, this is God's plan all along. The very last book of the Christian Bible is a book called Revelation. And it's a book filled with powerful images and symbols. It's not an easy book to read. But in one of the most powerful images and symbols we have is of God's kingdom, his rule fully come, things the way they should be. And we have Jesus imaged as a lamb. And we read this, people are gathered around God's throne. After this, I looked and there was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, from all tribes, peoples, and languages standing before the throne and before the Lamb, robed in white, with palm branches in their hands. And they cried out in a loud voice, saying, "Salvation belongs to our God, who is seated on the throne, and to the Lamb." God's plan to redeem the world through Jesus Christ and to build a people for himself from all nations in all our amazing diversity is coming true in our lifetime. So in closing, three questions come to me. You know, what does this transition mean for us here on campus? This transition which is going on all around the world. What does it mean for us here? Three questions. First question, if you're an international student, or if you're a Canadian of non-majority cultural background, if you're curious about Jesus, you're wondering about Jesus Christ and Christianity, you're unsure if you want to plunge in deeper, I just want you to think about this. Why is it that people all around the world, from every culture and nation, from your culture and nation, are being drawn to Jesus Christ? What is it about him that all people everywhere find so attractive? To follow Jesus, people are giving up their sins, laying aside their brokenness, but they're not giving up their culture or their language to become westernized. On the contrary, they're finding that their own cultural stories are being healed and renewed by the biblical story. They're finding that Jesus Christ is the answer to some of their deepest cultural longings. So they're expressing their faith, in fact, with remarkable cultural manifestations. Just as an example, from the Canadian Arctic, this is architecturally one of the great churches built by a people who have recently converted to Christianity. In the Canadian Arctic, people traditionally have built homes out of ice and snow. They've built igloos. And St. Jude's Anglican Church in Iqaluit, which is in the Canadian province of Nunavut, is built as an igloo. And I love this example because in the Canadian Arctic, this igloo is refuge from the dark. It's refuge from the cold. It's a safe place. And Inuit Christians are expressing their belief in the church and in Jesus Christ through this. Another example, just in passing, is through art. Here in Korea, where the sage has traditionally had a very important cultural and religious role, we find Jesus imaged as the sage, and people are coming to him for healing and to be blessed. Think about why people in your culture are turning from old gods or no gods to follow Jesus Christ. Second question, if you're like me and a kind of a boring old regular Canadian Christian, here's a question for you. Are we ready for the church to be turned upside down? Are we ready for a new world Christianity where the global South has priority? I mean, we've been in the driver's seat for a while. We have the money, we've been calling the shots, but things are changing, and the fact is we have so much to learn from Christians from other cultures. Are we ready for it? And imagine how our Indian and Chinese Christian brothers and sisters can tell us about what it means to tell others about the faith in a context of persecution. Or Christian brothers and sisters in Africa or Latin America who live with joy and hope in contexts of often great poverty, government oppression. And I think that's one of the places where we're going to learn to read the Bible differently, is on this question of justice. Show the map, Seth. This map is deliberately skewered according to the UN statistics on development. So this is a map that shows the world according to poverty. And as you can see, North America and Europe have shriveled because of their wealth. And the parts of the world that experience great poverty have swollen, particularly Latin America, Africa, and South Asia. These are exactly the places where the church is growing. This means that the church that's emerging in the 21st century is a church of the poor. Are we ready for that? For a church of poverty? A lot of the times in the West, we've confused the American dream with the Christian life, so that we assume a Christian life of surplus, success, self-esteem. I think our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world can teach us to read the Bible afresh, with an eye to justice and righteousness, and to hear Jesus Christ's own teachings on what it means to love our neighbor. Last question, and I'm throwing this question out to you guys as a Christian club on campus. This is a question for UCM. You're a club on campus, not just any club, though. As a Christian club, you're living out God's story of wanting to bless the nations in Jesus Christ. You've got multi-ethnicity in your DNA, in your spiritual DNA. And you've got a mission from the Spirit to all nations. What effect could that have on campus? This is a campus where we want diversity, we want inclusion, we want respect. And yet we know that there's intolerance, there's racism on campus, there's fear. What effect could a Christian club have on this campus? Could God be calling you as a club to a role of leadership? I'm not going to answer the question. Just going to throw it out there, let it linger for a while. So thanks for your time and for listening. This is an amazing moment in the history of the church, and your generation is going to experience it in full, and that's really exciting. So bless you. Thank you. Thank you.